Okay, as I've just said, this is the point at which I admit that I have to wear reading glasses because I realise my notes for the next session have done so small in my little notebook that unless I do this, I'm going to be blind. I'm not going to be able to see what I'm doing. So I apologise for this. I might do a bit of this as the thing goes on. Let me introduce for the first full session of this afternoon after John's introduction to GGS2. Our two interview guests this afternoon. On the furthest on my left is Richard Howe. I now know we have to pronounce it Richard Howe. And on my immediate left, Ben Morales Frost. And Ben and Rich, I'm told I can call him. Ben and Rich have adapted Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana as a stage musical. And that's really all I'm going to say at this stage, other than just to say this session was planned for last year, because last year the whole thing had been planned, tickets were sold, etc., etc. It was on at the Watermill Theatre in Newbury. It was going to start, I think, in June and then July, and I'm told it was extended for 2 weeks because ticket sales were so good. And then I can't remember what it was, but something happened last year that meant that this musical never got staged last year. So we're now in the position of being updated. I'll do that as the first thing in a moment. Updated on the state of play on that. But we're also in the position, of course, of my not having seen the musical. I got tickets to see it in Newbury and then COVID struck. So I'm conducting this interview having seen not a stage version. They very kindly allowed me to see the play script of Act One. I haven't seen the whole thing, but I've read the whole of Act One. So I'm coming from that sort of position. I know, obviously, the book. I know a bit about what they've got planned for the first part of their musical. And that's it. So we're going to have an interview about where we are with it, the background of these two chaps, and then on to talk about Our Man in Havana and the whole business of adapting it as a musical for the stage. So before I stop rabbiting and let them talk a little bit, can you welcome them? Okay, you know the first question. What is the state of play on the musical Our Man in Havana? Where are we now?
Well, in that nothing is certain in this life except musical theatre. The situation's it's pretty rosy. We're looking to do it. The Watermill Theatre in Newbury is gearing up to effectively. It's now back at capacity, but gearing up to effectively relaunch next year, and we're looking to do the full run. Probably sort of springtime, either just before or just after spring, depending. Some of our cast and company are actually Cuban, for verisimilitude, and depending on their availability, it'll be either before or after spring. So yeah, it's all very good, and finally Ben and I have stopped crying. It's going good.
And presumably those good ticket sales have boosted that process. You didn't go through a period where you thought, this is actually never going to be staged now. Our chance has gone with COVID.
I'd say it was considering how it was, which was pretty awful, it was fairly positive about the show from the outset because people didn't really cancel their tickets. Lots of people were given options to have refunds on tickets. And I know we've had that with quite a lot of things, theatre, concerts and flights and things. And most people with the Watermill very generously elected to keep their booking. Right. So effectively, they're hoping, I guess, just port the entire
transfer to next
run
year,
with everybody sitting in exactly the same place to an entirely different month from the original plan.
Right.
Well, we stopped production at an odd point in that when you're developing a theatre show, there are various stages of pre-production, and one of them is something called the white card, where the set design is presented in a very sort of primitive form with just white bits of cardboard for the other departments, say things like there's no way we'll be able to light that, or that bed isn't big enough for two people, which is, well, maybe that's just in my house. And we got to that stage, and that white card model was made, which would then have been dismantled and more elaborate things built. And that white card has apparently been put in storage. These things normally only last a few days. It's been put in storage and will be got out and revisited exactly at the point that it should have been, but 2 years later. So it's covered in dust, so it's quite exciting.
Unpaused.
Right, okay. Yeah. Now I'm going to work my way onto Armand in Havana, but I was deliberately, in my introduction, obscenely, sketchily brief about you two, because I want you to tell us about yourself as the first bit of the interview before we get onto Armand in Havana. I didn't even, it occurs to me now, point out that you're the scriptwriter on Armand in Havana and you're the music man. Mm-hmm. So, just to fill us in before we get onto Armand in Havana, and for the moment excluding the other work that you two have done jointly, because I want to come onto that as a collaboration sort of theme before we get onto Armand in Havana. Tell us about your careers up to now. What have you been doing with your lives since you became responsible paid adults? In whatever order you want to go.
You start.
I'm not sure either of us are responsible yet, but that's still to come. I had a really strange route into theatre. I knew that I wanted to do theatre from university, but actually at university I was doing architecture, which was a terrible decision, and I'm not entirely sure how I ended up doing that. I spent my entire time whilst I was there doing theatre and music and performing and getting involved in writing things as well. And actually my way into the industry was from the production side. I ended up working for quite a while as a stage manager, and I started in the world of opera, both with Opera North and then the Royal Opera House, which was my move to London. But the incredible thing about working with those is working with the incredible directors, international directors, in rehearsal rooms and seeing how shows were put together. So my route in was sort of from music drama, but not explicitly what we now think of as musical theatre, which tends to be a little bit more lighthearted, and seeing how those were put together. Then I sort of, there was a very bizarre year in which I made a move across to working in musical theatre, and ended up getting the attention of Andrew Lloyd Webber's head of music, which was turns out to be a really strange sequence of events, whereby I ended up sort of supervising the album that he was doing of the sequel to The Phantom of the Opera. And that was kind of my way in. I then became his assistant for 5 years and saw how musical theatre was put together, sort of, I'm going to say at the coal face, but it was quite a rarefied coal face.
Yes.
And a very, very specific kind of musical theatre as well that he was doing. But that was sort of my baptism into this world.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've done film work?
Yes. So I was attempting to also get into the film world. And actually last year, in some ways, because of theatre projects being put on hold for a while, I was able to pursue sort of making film contacts in a much more thorough way than I was able to do whilst simultaneously doing theatre. So yes, in the last couple of years I have started doing some film and television work as well, which is interesting. It's absolutely nothing like theatre at all. It's normally the complete opposite. The work has been done and then you add music to it, whereas we're creating in musical theatre, we're creating from the ground up,
yeah,
and imagining things as musical sequences telling a story, if that makes, sure, that makes sense.
And you've got a thing on your record that's called program music, have you?
It's production music, I think.
Production music,
yes.
Is it right? What's production music?
Well, this is one of the things I had to dabble with in lockdown, and I think almost all musicians, all composers have had to do this. Production music is also known as library music. It gets used a lot in the world of television. It's basically writing music for no particular purpose. You write music that maybe encapsulates a mood or an idea or a theme. So for instance, you might do 10 pieces of music to make a little album of tension music. And that's it. And you provide nothing else other than those words. And then it gets picked up by people editing television. Mm-hmm. And this will happen. Things like if you watch the Bake Off or anything like that, you very quickly realise that there are set pieces of music that are being used for things. And what the creators of that will have done is go to one of these production music companies, typed in tension music.
For when the souffle goes
exactly.
flat. And then, yeah.
Exactly. And then picked something from that. So it's, as I was saying, lots of composers have done that during lockdown
right.
because everything else stopped.
Right.
And it was quite a good way of...
And that's called production music.
Production
right.
music,
right.
yeah. It's not an especially satisfying way to work because you're working for no defined sort of end point. But it's quite nice practicing these things and imagining situations and writing music to them.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, come on then, Rich. Tell us about...
Well, I started... When I left university, I did a little bit of acting and comedy at university, and so I got a job working initially at Ealing Studios and then the BBC for about 10 years for BBC radio and television, writing sitcoms and sketches and jokes for Sandy Toksvig for about 10 years. And it got to a point, which is wonderful, and it's a lovely way to earn a living. But it got to a point where there's only so many jokes you can make about. This was about 2010, so. Do you know, I can't even remember what's happening in 2010. What government do we have in 2010?
Before the darkness.
It's a general election. Oh, right, yes.
Coalition government.
Oh, yeah, it was nightmarish. So every week you do... And, of course, the BBC, they're very good at balancing things. But when you've got a coalition government of two parties and you're making... which means you don't have to worry about the Liberal Democrats because they kind of have power anyway. So you can make a joke about the Conservatives. You then need to make the exact same joke at the opposite... end of the spectrum for the Labour Party, which is not easy if they've not done anything funny that week. So it got if you could imagine such a time. So it was an odd business, and we had a mutual friend who is now a very distinguished theatre producer, but he wasn't then, so I won't mention his name. And he and Ben were chatting about a musical theatre competition or something where. In town, in London, where you could enter songs, just little songs, and they'd all be judged, and there was a bit of prize money. It was all good fun. And Ben had a hankering to do that, but he needed somebody to do the words. And working with Andrew Lloyd Webber at the time, so the only person he had to do the words there was Don Black. And of course, you know, why would he go there? So he went further afield, and he asked Peter, who isn't his real name. Our mutual friend, if he knew anyone who could write lyrics. And Peter said, no, but I know somebody who can write jokes. And it's more or less the same thing. It's just the punchlines have to rhyme, which is kind of true. And so I wrote my first song to a tune that you constructed for this thing. It didn't win the competition. That'd be too much like a fairy story. But it did all right, didn't it? It did all right. And we decided to do a few more little bits. And those little bits became a series of short stories and vignettes and things, and then all of a sudden we were doing Around the World in 80 Days in Singapore, which never happened. There was a small war, but that's where we started. And from then I've been working in theatre. So I left the BBC and started living in penury, writing my own stuff.
Right. So that's led us on quite nicely to the bit before we get onto the Armand in Havana, which is your collaborations. You've collaborated on what? What are the things you've done together before Armand in Havana?
Well, the first project that really got off the ground, we dabbled with Around the World in 80 Days, we wrote a one-woman show that, these were sort of explorations in things, but the first show that really got going was at Wellingborough. We did an adaptation of A Christmas Carol, and we were introduced to this producer. He commissioned it, and it was incredibly generous to take a punt on an unproven team, as we were. He'd heard some of our material, and then entrusted us with the Christmas show. And the setup for that was, I think, a cast of eight, all of whom play instruments as well. So they are the band and the cast. And we had to tell this story, but it also had to be aimed at ages I think the brief was 3 to 103.
That was the easy bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is quite a wide range of ages to pitch writing for. And it had to be fairly short as well, so very succinct. And it is, I mean, it is a short story, but there's still more of it to tell than the time we had allotted to tell it in.
Yeah.
And we developed this show, and it went really, really well. And that was sort of the beginning of us.
Stardom.
Well, people being willing to part with money. When we started writing these shows in isolation, they were ideas that we flogged. But now we're in a position where we still flog ideas, but people listen, and that there is a chance they'll give us some amount of money to explore the ideas. I mean, these aren't huge sums. I mean, if they were, but it was the first one, and from that a producer called James Seabright, who produces all sorts of stuff in London. He does the Potted Potter pantos and thing, Potted Panto and those sorts of things. He backed us very early on to do an to do a version of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which, for those of you who know that Goethe wrote it, it's 400 words of German, so it's not an easy thing to turn into a two-hour musical by any stretch of the imagination. And so, which is why it's taken us 9 years to do it. But that's actually happening now. We did it earlier this year. I had to film it because of COVID, a version of this show, and now that's getting a bigger, better budget, and we're reworking it for something marvellous next year. I can't say more than that. I've realised I've signed a non-disclosure, so again, forget what you've heard.
And you've done Billy the Kid.
Yes, now that was a National Youth Music Theatre Commission, which is this extraordinary organisation. They get together every summer, and they do 3 or 4 productions, normally 2 of which they have commissioned. So it's new writing, and it's actually quite rare in the world of musical theatre for people to pay for new writing. And the fact that the NYMT do it and support new teams as well is a very gratifying thing. So we did that 4 years ago, recorded an album of the whole thing, and then it just had a second production with them this year, which was lovely. We met a lot of the original cast again, and they came and said hello, and it was just, you know, very nice to see it back on its feet again. And it's about, I think it's the there might be a Chinese production next year,
wow,
which is being spoken about, which is exciting. So it's nice that some of our productions are sort of making their way out into the world.
Very big in Shanghai. Very big. Oh yes.
Yes. So yeah, that should be
okay. So let's get on to Our Man in Havana. Now, this is the $64,000 question, mm-hmm, and depending on your answer to this, you might be drummed out of the building.
Okay.
Are both of you, either of you, Graham Greene fans?
Well, it's interesting. He is a very... I was introduced to Graham Greene through this novel for this project, and I hadn't read any before that. And was delighted to find something so interesting and complex to work with, but it was Rich who recommended it to me.
Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana, this will sound like a tall tale, but unlike everything else I'm about to say, is true. I was a scientist before I became a comedian, which, when you study science, physics was my science at a university, at one of our better universities, you're not allowed to go anywhere near the arts because you know, there's a small war between the two sort of humanities and sciences. And so I hadn't really read an adult book until I got to about 19, when I was at university and I was friends with somebody who was reading English. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of getting into theatre. I quite like acting, but they're doing things like they're doing plays like by these unknown writers like Ibsen and Chekhov, and I don't know who these people are. So I said, I need to kind of read some stuff. So she suggested I read a few playwrights, and I said, but I'd like some, you know, storybooks. I like storybooks, and she said, well, okay. And she gave me a list, and the first one was, I like Bond. So she said, okay, well, this is a This is a spy story. You like spy stories. It's called Our Man in Havana. So it was technically the first adult book I ever read. And I made the mistake of telling the artistic director of the theatre who bought this that, thinking that that would charm him. But actually, he suddenly thought that I might actually be borderline illiterate, and we very nearly lost the contract. But no, I meant it in the way that it in a very real sense started my love affair with all kinds of literature, and I have read since the oeuvre, even Stamboul Train. You know, are there any fans of Stamboul Train?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh no! Because that made me very cross. I got very cross. But anyway, we're not here to discuss Stamboul Train. So yeah. So I read it and I read everything and love him very much. And the place we took this show to, because it was an idea that we came up with to adapt it, and took it to a venue that might appreciate it as well, had very recently done an adaptation, this sort of cross-pollination of ideas. They did an adaptation of The Lady Killers, which obviously stars Alec Guinness, and Alec Guinness was in the film. So, and there was something else as well that meant that ours was kind of in between.
They were talking about an Agatha Christie, and
the various things that were kind of the right area and era and literary pedigree. And when we came in with this Graham Greene, it just seemed like quite a nice fit. And it's an irresistible title in that it is a jolly spy story with lots of gags and things, but it is also very subversive and has stuff you can stick in just under the top level, which makes any piece of storytelling richer, but particularly musical theatre, which sometimes struggles to put the dark stuff in.
Okay, so we get to a point, I've followed the sequence, we get to a point where Rich says to Ben, we're going to do a musical version of Our Man in Havana. And Ben then reads it and says, yeah, okay, that's fine. What then happens? How do the two of you create a musical Our Man in Havana? What's the process?
Well, I thought, my first impression on reading the book is how little emotion Green explains about his characters. He doesn't ever let them say what they're feeling, particularly. And he certainly doesn't really let them, in sort of prose, he doesn't really go into their thoughts at all. What happens is the way he presents it is you will know this, they say things and they do things, and there's so much subtext going on. And actually, my first impression reading this was how ripe it was for exploring the gaps between those sentences, those thoughts and those story beats. Because what musical theatre does is allow you to pause moments and explore what people are thinking or their motivations for things. And in a way that you can also do a little bit in film with close-up as well. And certainly in the world of musical theatre, that it gives you those opportunities. So I could immediately see why Richard suggested this. And I think the first step we took was for you to boil the essence of the novel down into a presentable two-hour script.
Yeah, yeah. It's adaptation to drama is it's a whole subject in itself, of course. But I'll condense it a little with what little I know. It's a novel can ignore certain rules or go beyond certain rules that drama to most audiences it simply wouldn't be acceptable. There was once a time of Aristotelian unities of time and place in drama. Everything had to happen over a short period of time in a certain place with a certain number of people. Everyone had to change. At least one Russian had to die. I think they were the original rules. But there are certain unities and there are certain constraints that an audience expect, which doesn't mean that anything that any character is or says or does is prescribed. But it does mean that a sort of shape, it is necessary to follow a certain shape. A certain shape. The beauty of Green is that because he was a screenwriter as well, is that and a very dialogue-heavy author, is that it looks like something would be very easy to boil into a script or screenplay, in that you just remove everything that hasn't got quotation marks around it and put it in order. And Our Man in Havana is particularly useful because it's like a couple of other novels actually. It is split into five parts. Dramas are usually three acts, but it's quite simple to pair them up. The act one that you've read is the first three parts of the novel, I think, and what we call act two, the bit after the interval, are parts four and five. But dialogue, also dialogue being read, is slightly different to dialogue being read aloud, and Graham Greene's dialogue doesn't sound like Graham Greene's dialogue when you read it aloud. When you read it in your head, you get the temperature and the rhythm and the verbosity and the language of the characters. When you get actors to read those lines aloud, if it hasn't been, and we're not talking about modernising it at all, but if we're not changing some of the rhythms, it sounds too prosy, because in a novel you can't separate dialogue from prose as easily. So what I had to do was take a plot that is very complicated, boil it down to something that could be told in 2 hours with a certain number of characters, not all the characters from the book, but a certain number of them, but stick to the story of the book. You have to, I mean, if you're adapting somebody's work, you need their story, but the plot can, the difference between the two being story is an emotional arc, plot is just the stuff that happens. I could adjust the plot, but I couldn't change the story, and I had to do it within 2 hours. And it boiled down to taking James Wormald out of the book, setting him down, surrounded by a band and an audience, finding out what he is worried about quite early on in a musical. There's something called an I Want song, often, where you have to, right at the outset, say what your lead character is after. Figure out what he wants, in this case, to a very large extent, to just make his daughter happy. And then put something in his way, which are other characters' incidents, and keep doing that until he gets to a point which diverges quite markedly from his initial aim, but it gets to a point where, things can get really bad for him, and firearms are involved. If you know the story, which I'm sure you do, firearms are involved with lethal outcome. There are similarities in this adaptation, which I shan't go into. So it was about taking this character and pushing him through for 2 hours, and it became quite organic then. And then taking it to the music department meant that there was a beating human being that we refocused the whole thing around, that you could give blood to with music.
Mm. I think the first thing you did after that, once you had a sort of 3 or 4 page synopsis, I suppose bigger than a synopsis, what we'd call a beat sheet, right, series of storytelling moments, then you expanded it out. And you sort of, I think you treated it a bit like a balloon. You kept inflating into a larger version, and we kept adding bits in until it finally was able to, I don't know where my metaphor's going here, hold its own weight.
Fly.
Oh, yes.
Fly.
Fly. Yeah.
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 Okay. Yeah.
So we've got, I've seen a script or part of the script, and from what you say, Rich, this is the explanation of my question, in which I saw very little of Graham Greene's actual dialogue. I could, having read the novel and then looked at this script, I thought, ah, yes, that's from Graham Greene, but I was struck by how much of it wasn't directly Graham Greene, and you've explained why. That's how it happened.
I could have taken, but also I need these characters to sing, and they can't sing in Graham Greene dialogue because, unfortunately, his doesn't rhyme. Most of the time, some of it does. There's that bit in the heart of the matter, which is like a soliloquy from Shakespeare. But otherwise, because they had to be the same character. It's terrible when musical theatre productions get somebody to sing and they're basically singing in a different language with a different vocabulary. And on a piece like this, you want them to be the same. So I had to fit his English, fit his dialogue to his lyrics, to everything that he says, which meant, again, it's not modernizing the dialogue and it's not putting it in my voice. What I tried to do was an impression of Graham Greene, if he'd been writing it from scratch. So I read the book several times, then I put it away. And apart from a few absolutely key quotes, which is more Hasselbacher, actually, than Wormald, I shut my eyes and walked around with a cheroot and did an impression of Graham Greene. Yeah.
And daiquiri.
And daiquiri, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so how, I mean, for the collaboration to work, you've got to write some dialogue which is just spoken by the characters, but then they break into song. Do you know in advance what the balance between the dialogue and the singing bits, to put it crudely, is going to be? Or is that just worked out as you work through the script? And is that done in consultation with the music man?
Mm. That's a really interesting question. I think it's sort of, certainly for me, very much a feel thing. I mean, because of the nature of musical theatre, there are points when it does feel strange that somebody hasn't spoken for a while. But then there are points when you think, oh, it's been too much singing and we would just need to crack on with a scene here. And I think that's a bit of an organic process. But certainly in as we were developing it up, as Rich was doing it from this beat sheet out into sort of larger forms, you do work out where the songs are going to go. You work out what the songs are going to achieve, how they're going to move the story on, or if they're going to move the story on, because very occasionally you can get away with doing a song that is quite indulgent and just deals with somebody's emotion.
Or a theme. I mean,
there
are things that we can't always unpack in terms of the drama of this, and you know, some of the subtleties of truth and lies, some of the intentions Green would have had in writing the story, not just the lampooning of jolly old England, which we also do, but yeah, truth and lies. It's not appropriate for characters to sit there and discuss morality most of the time in a two-hour show, but you can sing a song about it, which, gosh, that makes it sound really trivial, doesn't it? But it's true, you can, and it's nice.
Yeah, truth and lies. I've got your script open at Hasselbacher, a few lines of lyrics. What is the truth but an item of faith, unencumbered by proof and held with conviction?
Seems quite
has quite a modern apposite ring to me.
It's funny you say that. It's from my Catholic upbringing, and indeed, perhaps share with Graham Greene. I was thinking of truth. Defining truth as in the truth we might get from scripture or believing in something. But yes, it does also have the modern relevance of being rubbish.
But was that deliberate, this kind of, this notion of, what's the phrase I jotted down, there's many a truth in the lie? There's a lot of playing on that idea of what is truth, what's a lie.
Yes.
Hasselbacher ends up persuading Wormald that the way to make his money is by telling lies to these people who are willing to give him money for telling lies.
By telling them the truth they want to hear. I mean,
yes.
truth is a very... this was one of... We picked various themes from the novel, and some of which... I mean, Greene himself had regrets about his handling of perhaps the Batista regime in the novel, which, through consultation with Cuban nationals and people from the region, we've also addressed, I hope, to be slightly more in line with something he would now approve of. But in terms of other themes, his lampooning of the British system and state is always, you know, it's evergreen, but there are specific elements within that, such as truth and lies, which are implied in the novel and get at the heart of what's wrong, assuming there is anything wrong with our state at the moment, or indeed all such controlling states. And it's the idea of presenting any information and calling it reality. There is no... A photo isn't real in that it represents something that simply no longer exists. And as a former physicist, nothing is true. We're all made up of little things that contain smaller things, that contain even smaller things, that right the way down contain little wiggly worms. And that's map, but it's, that also is true.
Okay. Let's see what you've done to the original then. We've got a female Hasselbacher.
Mm.
Tell me about that. How did that come about?
Well, that was, I think, a casting conversation. It wasn't written specifically with that in mind at all, but quite frequently these days, the gender of your cast members isn't often particularly baked in to the writing. And so when it comes to actually casting, the directors often raise the point, well, could this be played by a woman or a man? Certainly in the original novel, there's very, very poor balance between men and women, you know, amongst the characters.
For
modern eyes. And our director suggested, well, what if this gender was of this character was changed?
Right.
And that incredibly neatly helps balance out our casting. It makes for an interesting reading as well, because actually I don't think there's any particular reason why Hasselbacher needs to be a man.
No.
It actually helps in the solution, because Hasselbacher has secrets in the novel, which is how he gets employed by whatever the enemy is that employs him, the East Germans or the Russians. Our Hasselbacher has secrets, and something that would be pertinent to a modern audience, the secrets are sexual, and our Hasselbacher is an older German doctor out in Cuba from a period between the two wars, who has letters from a lover, from a, we assume, female lover, and that could be used as blackmail against her. So she's vulnerable in... she's vulnerable in a similar way to the original, but in a way that I think a modern audience will empathise with. And somebody like Wormald, who this great tragedy, because the relationship between the two men in the novel is this great friendship, and it continues to be here. There's no sexual tension between the two. They're different ages and different sexual orientations, but there's a poignancy in that they can share so much, and yet they are separated by race, class, religion, and time. So, yeah, it actually works. And it was quite honestly to create gender parity in the cast,
sure,
which is essential in all modern drama for all of the obvious reasons. And there's no reason, just because you're doing something that was written before gender parity was even considered or arguably necessary, or probably, it is no reason that should not be the case, and you shouldn't move mountains to make that work. We did, however, it does help the story, I think, or at least it helps our telling of it. It will make our telling and what happens to Hasselbacher clearer, and the audience will be more sympathetic with it. I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not. Started with the viewpoint of being the green police who are saying, why have you done this to our favourite character? How dare you? Yeah. But just to run a couple of things past you, rereading the novel, and I'd forgotten when I then read your act one, we got Millie, in your version, sets fire to the changing rooms, I think.
She sets fire to the same thing she sets fire to in the book, doesn't she?
I thought in the book she set fire to a small boy.
Oh, yes, that was a discussion. That was the producer saying, no, we can't make her somebody...
a biological artist.
Ironically, in the other show that we're currently working on, Sorcerer's Apprentice, I wrote that there's a character in it, the eponymous... apprentice is a Greta Thunberg type, and I wrote that she sets fire to the terrible factory in the story that's causing all the problems at the beginning, and that went, and everyone was very happy, and the director's very happy, and we're casting, and the producer said to me, you realise the lead character is a 16-year-old arsonist, and I said, yes, I think that's fun, I think that's jolly. He said, it's not, take it out, change it. So there are certain mores that we observe, so that might be why that was clipped.
That's fine.
Yes.
And what about, I've got the Reverend Mother of the school that Millie's at mm-hmm. is arrested for sedition.
Ah,
she's
yes.
helped the rebels.
Yes.
That's not in the book, is
no,
it?
No, it's not.
How did that... Is that just for a laugh line?
No, it's not, actually. This was... The Green Estate have been incredibly encouraging and helpful with this. They've been absolutely wonderful. One of the things that was pointed out, because these go through many, many, many heartbreaking drafts, but one of the things that was quite rightly pointed out was that, which may or may not be connected with the man himself and his wishes to have betrayed the Batista regime as something more than background. Because in the novel, all the characters are not Cuban, except for Segura, and the background, and Segura is kind of charming and wonderful in a very evil, tortury way. And the background just looks jolly and poor, but jolly, and they're making the best of it. In a way, it's not explored as much as it could be, because there's not room for it. It's not what the novel's about. In this adaptation, we are working with our MD is Cuban. One of our cast is one of them's Cuban, one's from Argentina, which yeah. I know is a different country, but it's the same area of the world, so we're going to count it. And it's not even the same area. They're literally thousands of miles apart. There's racism built into every aspect of what we do. But anyway, so there's a quote. There's a Paul quote. In being sensitive to the culture, it was important, and this was encouraged by the estate, actually, to make it clear that the regime is horrible. There's also a tiny little bit of dialogue about a young man being dragged into the street and beaten by police because he's young, which is alluded to. There's something about youth in the book being in itself a crime at the
yes.
point. And it was a crime because, as always, the youth are a little bit more firebrandy, and whatever the ruling classes want to give them a short, sharp shock, or in Batista's case, torture and kill them. And it was important to put that in. So what the Reverend Mother... Oh, yes, it is funny that it's a nun doing that, but it's also something... I mean, bearing in mind what the Catholic Church did only 10 years after this book set. Oh, no, 10 years before this book set, probably. It's not unbelievable that but she might... And it's quite sad. I mean, she's arrested for sedition, so they're going to kill her. And it is kind of a joke, but it's very dark.
Yeah.
And Millie is aware of it, and the fact that Millie's psychology is very interesting. Today she'd be diagnosed with something, I think, very particular, with an actual name and probably a DVD number? DV,
Narcissism.
Yeah. But here she just seems vaguely psychotic, whereas in actual fact I think she processes things in a slightly different way, and it's not... It's even though her the mother figure in her life, the Reverend Mother, is being taken away to be killed, she's concentrating on buying a horse. I think that tells you an awful lot about her and all of this, and also why Wemmel worries so much. His daughter isn't well. It's a reading of it. So, yeah. Does that answer your question, or does
yeah.
that just sound like lies?
No, that's true. So we get to a point where you've got a kind of working script, and that working script has got dialogue in it, and it's got lyrics in it, and then is it as crude as this? Then that gets handed over to Ben, and Ben says, right, I need to sort some music out for this stuff. Is that what then happens?
It can sort of begin there, but it kind of starts a conversation, actually.
Yeah, parallel to all of this, I start my sort of music explorations at the same time as Rich sort of puts his pen to paper
right. okay.
first. And I've done this on every one of our projects. I sort of spend, I don't know, a fortnight or something writing as many musical ideas as I can, sort of responses to the tone of the piece, responses to the book, to the plot, to let's just try and write some Cuban music, see what happens.
And this is before you've seen the specifics of what...
Exactly.
Just responding to the themes and feelings.
And then before we really have written any songs properly, and before any lyrics were written on this as well, we then get together and we listen through all of my ideas. And there are normally, I don't know, about 90 minutes worth of...
Gold. Yeah.
Some platinum, but not all. And some, definitely some fool's gold in there as well. And we pick things from it that we like. So you respond in a very, sort of emotional way.
Gay emotional.
To these things, yes. Where you'll say, oh, that feels like something that we could use for a bit of Millie music, something like that. And we end up sort of labelling some of these ideas. Most of them are discarded entirely because they're not sufficiently interesting enough or catchy enough, or they don't really say anything. So they go. But we end up from this sort of 90 to 120 minutes of material of mine with maybe about 20 minutes of usable ideas. So then what it means is when we actually start writing, I already have a well of resources to draw on and sort of ideas for each moment. So at that point, no songs have been written in their entirety, even musically. I might have a melody for a particular thing, but it hasn't taken on its full song form by that point. And it's only once we get writing and we start to develop and sort of flesh out those ideas, right, that they sort of become songs.
And while you're doing this kind of fortnight or so's work, did you look at the music that was done for the film version, for instance? There's a Malcolm Williamson opera of Our Man in Havana. There's a Clive Francis musical version, isn't there, of Our Man in Havana?
I think so.
Were you aware, Stroke? Did you go to any of that to give you any ideas? Just opened your own imagination.
Yeah, I'd watched the film, I don't know, 6 months before we started writing. So none of the music was sort of...
in your head.
Yes, this is legally...
Yes.
None
that's
of the music.
That very clear.
But no, I didn't listen to any of the other sort of musical versions.
But I mean, apart from any legal questions, which I appreciate, of course, you just don't want contaminated by somebody else's...
No, because then you end up viewing it through somebody else's sort of musical lens as well.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to do was create as authentic a Cuban sound as I could make for certain moments in the show. I mean, there are points in the musical where they are supposed to be hearing music that's happening at the time, you know, diegetic moments of the score. So there's music happening in the bar that they're talking in, that sort of thing. And I wanted that to sort of overflow into the surrounding sections of music as well, so that we have a sort of scale from authentic Cuban music, as authentic as can be written by a middle-class white man in London. But even so, that was my attempt at that. And then at the other end of the scale, we had the moments that are set in London with the chief of staff and
SIS.
Exactly, SIS and the very, very British characters there. So I sort of, for them, chose a very mid 20th century vocabulary of
limpish
English composers. So, but us also sort of drawing on a slightly Edwardian ideas as well. So I think what I hope to do for the British moments is channel everything from Elgar, Walton, all the way through perhaps back to touches of Arthur Sullivan, of Gilbert and Sullivan. Just little moments, but to make a very distinct difference between the British music and the Cuban music. But then, of course, once you've done that, you can then start to use things more subversively as well. And that's one of the, I think, sort of the magical things that can happen with music. You can bring musical moments into other moments, into other points of the show, and use them and sort of invert them and say, well, isn't this an ironic conversation because of this incredibly jingoistic conversation we had earlier about the same thing? And you can sort of use the musical structure to make these links that were or are sort of there in the novel. If you choose to read it like that, you can say all sorts of things.
And you've got as part of the musical structure of the thing this three-piece group, Is that right?
Is it right to describe them like that? No, it's...
How many people are playing instruments live, as it were, in this production?
Everybody.
Everybody. It's, everybody but the lead.
Right.
Or, well, you'll get him to shake something, will you?
He will, yes.
Yeah.
We wanted to make it. So, I sort of alluded to this a little earlier with A Christmas Carol. This, the theatre we're working at, the Watermill, sort of pioneered something called actor-musician productions, where the cast play the instruments as well. And it is phenomenally complicated and fiddly to put together, because you have to work out who can play an instrument when they're not acting, how those instruments relate to each other in terms of orchestration, to sort of make a band, to make a noise that you actually like. You have to think about whether people are using an instrument they blow, which means they can't sing, or whether it's an instrument that they can, for like a guitar, they can play and walk around with, or are they playing the piano, so they're immobile through the scene, but they can sing. It's very, it's fiddly, but it's a nice challenge. So when we pitched this idea, Our Man in Havana, to the Watermill, we said, we think we can do it with a cast of five people and an onstage pianist who is sort of part of the ensemble, part of the storytelling, but largely is rooted to the piano. And actually that character has become, or is the sort of beggar kind of character that is there in the very, very first few paragraphs of the novel, and is used partly as an illustration of the contrast in living between expats in Cuba, in Havana, and the local population. So we have a pianist, five people around them, who you hope, when you cast it, can play the instruments that you would quite like them to be. So I had to choose a palette of instruments that would enable us to make authentic Cuban music, traditional, well, not traditional, but 20th century English music, British music, and everything in between as well, at the same time as being able to sing during these things. So picking a palette of instruments.
And I also wanted them to act.
And he likes them.
You know, I like them
to act as well.
So, you know, it's not easy.
It was very, very tricky. So the approach we went with casting is a sort of wish list of what each character might be able to play.
Right.
And we went from there. So we did. We found a group of people who can do all these things. They can act.
Yeah, they are amazing.
They can sing. They can, between them, I think four of them are pianists. So they can sort of move around and swap. A couple of guitarists, double bass players, and everybody, because we tried this. As the last thing we did before lockdown happened was a sort of Cuban percussion workshop. So we got these cast members in, we sat them around, and we gave them all Cuban instruments. And our MD, as Rich was saying, MD being this beggar character, she's the... conductor, sort of musical director that holds, she's the glue at the center of this. She is a Cuban and has, she just has these musical styles in her fingertips, which is fantastic. So we got her to lead this percussion workshop. And it was really interesting to see people trying to pick up these unfamiliar rhythms. But it was seeing the sort of level of musicality that they had was helpful in choosing who we could cast.
It's very hard because there were strange percussion instruments, strange to my eyes. But then there were, it turns out I've been playing maracas wrong.
Yes, not a wind instrument after all.
No, I know. Goodness me.
Yeah. Well, who knew?
Yeah.
But I was just going to say I knew very little about Cuban music before writing this at all. So I did a huge amount of research into the authentic styles, the development of it, but of course Cuban music itself is descended from various African styles as well, which is a whole new world to look into. And so having a Cuban MD involved is incredibly helpful in sort of helping shape the way that this sounds and the way that this is played in creating that level of authenticity, which I'm trying to get to.
Yeah. I've got absolutely loads of questions still written down here, and still I haven't got onto them, and I'm not going to get onto them, but I want to give members of the audience a chance to pipe up if there are issues people want to raise. Otherwise, I'll continue with my questions. I'm not short of material here. Ian?
Well, it's one comment and one question. I mean, comment is the origin of your collaboration. I think it's almost exactly the same as Gilbert and Sullivan.
Ooh.
They started, and Gilbert was a satirist and a humorist, and they were brought together. So I'm just...
Well, that bodes well.
Have they done okay?
Did it work out?
Did they make it?
And the second one is just in the industry. I mean, is the destiny of commercial West End theatre just endless Hollywood film adaptations, or is there still room for original? Pretty Woman, I think it's the latest. Is there still room for original adaptations and drama within the commercial big budget West End?
That's interesting.
Bearing in mind we'll make more money when we go to the West End, so I don't want to offend anyone there. But I think commercial theatre, as opposed to independent theatre, I think there's room for all sorts of things, but at different scales. One of the problems with the West End is the theatres are all quite big, and therefore have to support quite big shows that run to get foreign audiences, tourists, and they have to be big and glitzy and glam. But there is a level that's still commercial below that. So it's still capitalist. It's still designed to make money, which is a good thing often in theatre, because if your idea isn't any good, people won't watch it. It doesn't really matter. So although Havana is an independent production, which will tour, hopefully, touch wood, if all goes well. We're working on something else, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which, although that does sound fairly glitzy, it ain't really. It's quite a small piece about it's an environmental message. It's a children's show, or a family show, but it's quite a small thing and quite cute and quite smart, I think. And it's for a commercial producer, and it will go into commercial theatres, but slightly smaller ones. And so I think there will always be, probably in the big things, yes, Back to the Future and whatnot. And when they try others, Amelie was although that was an adaptation, but musical theatre is always adaptation. There are about three that was, I mean, Carousel's an adaptation, Oklahoma's an adaptation, all adaptations. So that's not the problem so much. It's not so much the source material as, I suppose, the level and the standard of the production. I think the big things will always have big shows in. But you look at places like Alexandra Palace has just been done up. There are theatres opening for a slightly smaller level of commercial theatre. Stuff that we do, which is good and hopeful and nice. Does that sound fair?
You are right there. There is something irresistible to a producer about a familiar title.
Mm. The franchise.
Well, yes, you've got a sort of an immediate audience base with that, which must be quite reassuring to a producer. And I think probably with The Sorcerer's Apprentice, one of the attractions to the producer for that was it's a familiar title, but actually one of the upsides is that nobody knows what the story is.
No.
They just know the words The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah.
So, again, that's... We think of it as an original project, but there is clearly an element of this is an adaptation of something, even though we've not had any story to work with whatsoever.
I'm
on
spreading
that.
Star Wars music.
Yes, yeah.
That's not on the cards, is it? Still not Wars?
Well,
one day, I imagine.
Chewbacca's solo, I'd say
he's,
for that.
Yeah. I'd go if they used the London Symphony Orchestra in the pit. That would work.
Another question over here.
I don't know if you're able to tell us, but part of the story involves vacuum cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a big vacuum cleaner number?
Where there's a brand tie-in with Dyson, isn't there?
Yes. That nearly went bad with Brexit, but no, we're holding out. In a manner of speaking, there is a song that deals with We haven't seen the prop. The design for this thing, you'll probably be aware that it hinges on, the story hinges on him basically drawing a James Bond villain's lair machine based on his vacuum cleaner. So that vacuum cleaner itself will be something beautiful in 50s and chromium plated. I've been promised by our designer that it's an astonishing thing. We've not seen it. We've seen a tiny, on that white card I told you about, we've seen a tiny little model that looked like a little Dalek that'd fallen asleep. And I said, well, that's good, I like Daleks. But it's going to be a marvellous thing. But when it is transformed into these works of art, which it will be done during the course of the show, yes, the Brits do sing a song about... I wrote the lyric, but I can't remember anything about it. What's the one about?
It's worse than we feared.
Oh, it's worse than we feared. Yeah, which is a fun song about the size of the thing, with lots of, well, now I come to think of it, probably quite crude jokes. But but they're in the music, so you know, you won't notice them. No one listens to the lyrics. But yes, so sorry, in answer to your question, kind of, yeah, there is.
Yeah. I think we're out of time. Are there any? Is there one more quick question? Because if not, I'll call proceedings to a halt. Yeah.
Are you going to Disney for the Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Oh, to take it. Oh, as in, have I seen the Disney?
Fantasia.
Well, the story of Fantasia, the brooms and things, is just the poem. So we have something that includes that story moment. We have an hour leading up to it and an hour away from it is basically how we structure the show. Musically, that's a hard no, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. No, we didn't use any of that.
No.
But of course, it's out of copyright anyway. But,
you can't quite avoid the music, can you?
Oh, well, this is his great genius. You will forget... what's his name?
Duca.
You'll forget old Duckus. Who's Duckus, you'll say? Yeah.
No. We deliberately decided not to. Because the trouble is, they are so inseparable. You would have... Exactly. Even though that music wasn't written for the Disney film, it was 50 years.
None of that music was.
Exactly. But they are inseparable. So we decided we couldn't not... If we were going to not do the Mickey Mouse version, we had to also leave behind the music associated with that as well. So it's entirely new.
Okay, it's tea or coffee time. Just a couple of things before I encourage you to put your hands together for these two. First of all, I don't know whether you're dashing off, but if people do have questions that they'd like to kind of ask privately, if you're willing
to... If you want my number...
we can offer you a cup of coffee while you answer any questions, if you're willing to stay around for a few minutes. That'd be really good if there are any more questions. The other thing that occurs to me is that at some point, presumably you two are going to be able to perhaps let me know what's going to happen, when the thing's going to be on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
And I will publicise that to everyone. I edit the green newsletter so we can pass that out to everyone.
Thank you.
Make sure people know when this comes to fruition. We can all cram it. We can
organise a
coach trip.
They do a wonderful lunch.
They do.
Seriously, I'm not kidding. They really do. One of the reasons we pitched this particular theatre was for the lunches. Yeah, that isn't a lie. That really isn't.
Okay.
So I will keep people informed about that. So thanks very much. Let's all go to tea and coffee. And thank you.